Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank, which this week is holding a series of exceptional live recording sessions to cover our analysis of the economic consequence of the war in Ukraine as it is unfolding. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and I'm here with our senior fellow, Nicolas Véron, who is sitting in Washington, D.C. Hi, Nicolas.
Hi.
And I'm happy to have with us also Sylvia Merler, who is the head of research at Algebris Investments. Hi, Sylvia. Thanks for joining us today.
Nice to be here.
We would like to discuss today about the sanctions imposed on Russia and the ripple effects on the financial markets. I would like also to remind you that you can ask questions during this live recording session by connecting to Slido at slido.do and typing there the hashtag sanctions finance. We will also have it on our Twitter feed, so please don't hesitate to participate. Going back to the topic, so things are moving very fast on the war front, and we at Bruegel don't want to substitute ourselves to news outlets who are covering the events. But what we would like to try to do is to attempt a first analysis of the consequences at the economic level. In this specific episode, as I said, we're going to look at the sanctions that the US, the EU, and the UK have been approved in the past few days, which many other countries are joining as well. And we've seen so far three kinds of sanctions. One is targeted at individuals, and there is a set of more systemic ones, one targeted to banks and the other one targeted to the Central Bank of Russia. To set the scene and also explains and walk through our listeners those measures, Nicolas, could you help us to understand a little bit better? Give us a little bit of a compass over there.
Yeah, I think you already pretty much did, Giuseppe, and did it well. These are the financial sanctions. We're not talking about trade sanctions or other types of sanctions that can be important. But if you look just at the financial sanctions, as you just said, they are of three main buckets. The first one is sanctions on individuals. So we call them oligarchs, but you know, it's all kinds of individuals connected to the regime, including Mr. Putin himself. So that means that their foreign assets are frozen or even seized, and that basically they have a more difficult life than before when they could shop in Milan and go to shows on Broadways and things like that. The second one is sanctions on individual Russian banks. And here it's often mentioned in connection to SWIFT, which is a global financial sector infrastructure, which is basically a messaging system for banks. So that's where banks exchange messages about international transactions. But actually, the sanctions go beyond that. And there have been sanctions on banks announced by the US and the European Union in particular, but it's kind of a developing story. So the EU sanctioned three Russian banks last week before the invasion, and they added four more today, but that still represents only one quarter of the Russian banking system, more or less. And so it's still a very partial action that doesn't affect the entire Russian banking system, by which I mean that even after the, I think, 10-day period that they have taken for, you know, defined for banks to get their houses in order, only one quarter of the Russian banking system will be disconnected from SWIFT. So it's not a full disconnection of the country. And then the third thing, which you mentioned also, Giuseppe, is the sanction on the Russian Central Bank, and specifically the freezing of their foreign reserves in all the jurisdictions that participate, which include, of course, the United States, the Eurozone with the ECB, other EU countries, Canada, the United Kingdom, but also Japan, Switzerland, Singapore, and others. So it's not just the West. It goes beyond the West. It's a global coalition, which is a bit ad hoc, which includes, offshore financial centers like Switzerland or even, for example, Monaco, which had never taken that kind of sanctions before. So I think this is really interesting. It's also interesting because, you know, there have been examples in the past of sanctions against central banks, for example, with Afghanistan, Iran, Venezuela, you name it, but never a central bank that is part of the kind of the inner circle, if I can put it that way, like the Central Bank of Russia, it's a full member of the Bank for International Settlements, the Financial Stability Board, the Basel Committee. I mean, I know these names are not familiar to many in our audience, but that's kind of the core of the global financial system. So this is hitting much more at the core than any previous action, including, believe it or not, during World War II. So when the Bank for International Settlements didn't cover itself with glory by basically collaborating with the Reichsbank of the Nazi regime. So this is a big deal. Sorry, I should probably stop here. But I think, you know, sanctions against individuals, very differentiated. Sanctions against banks, SWIFT, work in progress. So far, the EU package is kind of underwhelming. And sanctions against the Russian Central Bank, completely unprecedented, big deal, massive impact, deterioration of the ruble and of financial stability in Russia. The Russians didn't see that one coming. So that's the one that is most forceful at this point.
Thank you, Nicolas. This complements very, very well the overall frame of the situation. Now, what I would like to understand, and I turn my eyes to Silvia, what I would like to understand or to start to understand is how those measures, which are unprecedented, which are particular, depends on the different measures that we are speaking, how those measures are actually having the intended effect of crippling the Russian economy. And we've seen just today the one of the many news that are arriving is the closing down of Sberbank in Europe. So is this bank was not really part of the ones that were targeted by the measures. So it seems like one of the collateral effects. But maybe we can start with that because it was the news of the day. But getting a little bit more of an idea how those measures are hitting the financial system in Russia.
Yeah, I think I will not start from that because it's a bit of a consequence of how the measures are hitting Russia. So I'll get to that at the end. I think long story short, what you could say is the Russian economy did a 20-year U-turn in 2 days, pretty much in terms of the macroeconomic situation that it currently finds itself in. Nicolas was saying the Russians did not see this one coming. I agree with that. I think a lot of the commentary that's been put out, also trying to understand the rationale for war, was really centered on this idea of fortress Russia. So this idea of the Russian economy being able to withstand isolation for a prolonged period of time. I think that was a reasonable assumption to make, but that was based on one piece of information that drastically changed over this week, which is the access to international reserves by the central bank. And I think that one measure, that one sanction is probably the most unexpected one, and it is the most consequential one in terms of macroeconomic impact. Speaking a little bit about that, so the Russian central bank has a huge amount of reserves in the order of around $630 billion. Something that's interesting is clearly someone was thinking, looking forward, I mean, having a forward-looking approach to this, but between 2014, so following the Crimean War till today, the composition of those reserves, both in terms of where they were geographically located and in terms of the currency composition, it changed very significantly. So back in 2014, it was mostly euro and dollars. Today, it's mostly gold and yuan. So composition shifted from mostly the West towards the East and actual dollar commodity that is mostly held at the Central Bank of Russia. Now, even so, the sanctions that was imposed on the Bank of Russia effectively makes it impossible for the bank to access around 40% of their international reserves. Why is that important? It's important because if you look at how much, like what you would use these reserves for, the obvious thing is paying for trade, paying for imports. The amount of reserves that the central bank would have in normal times, so if it had access to the entire amount of reserves, would be sufficient to pay for around 2 years of imports that Russia typically uses. So that's quite a long time. Going back to this idea of fortress Russia, right? So the idea that you can isolate yourself from the international financial system for as long as 2 years, if you actually can access your entire pool of reserves, except you cannot do that anymore now. So suddenly the time that you can live without having to massively curtail your import has been halved by these reserves. And that is before taking into account other ripple effects, like what we have seen in the past few days, runs on banks for foreign currency. So people trying to get as much foreign currency as they possibly can, because they anticipated correctly that the domestic currency, the ruble, would collapse in value, as it actually did, by 30% on Monday. So this imposes additional pressure on the central banks, and it means your amount of reserves, which is already significantly lower than you were expecting it to be, it's also melting faster than you probably had anticipated. So all these factors effectively put pressure on the Russian economy, and we've seen that in the collapse of the ruble on one end, and also in the significant increase in the estimated probability of default of the Russian government that we can see out of credit default swaps on the market at the moment, following the imposition of capital controls. So how does all this tie into your Sberbank question? So Sberbank is a Russian bank that also has a subsidiaries in part of Eastern Europe, so in Austria, Hungary, and a few other Eastern EU countries. Some of those subsidiaries experienced effectively bank runs when it was announced, the European sanctions were announced, for pretty much the same reason I was explaining in the Russian context. So in this case, it would be clients of those banks anticipating that they might come under pressure, they might fail for whatever reason, they might not be able to reimburse deposits that they were holding there. And this being a self-fulfilling kind of event led the two banks to be declared failing or likely to fail by the European authorities. And I hope that kind of ties all the things together in an understandable way.
Yes. I wanted to ask Nicola to follow up on Sberbank, but before that, because we had a question from the audience, which I think very much goes in line with what you just said. Maybe just a confirmation. A question from Sebastian Mack from the Jacques Delors Center in Berlin. He was asking which will do more damage to the global financial system: the exclusion of Russian banks from SWIFT or the freezing of Russians' central bank reserves. I think this very much connected to the reflection that you both were having at the moment. So maybe I wanted to take it at that stage before we move more into the consequences for those specific banks.
So I don't think we should look at the two things in isolation. They do reinforce each other. The fact that the Russian central banks cannot access its full amount of reserves obviously has implications for potential defaults and losses in the Russian economy. Now, the fact that the Russian economy is also tied to the global financial system via SWIFT, and now a lot of the transactions that would normally take place, of the payments that would normally take place, cannot take place, or at least are going to be significantly delayed until an alternative way is found. So those two things tie together and I think reinforce each other. I don't know if Nicolas has a different opinion on that, but...
Yeah, I mean, I think Sebastian's question was about the damage to the global financial system. And I think there is a prior in that question, which is the global financial system is damaged. I'm not sure one can distinguish between the damage from the Russian aggression on Ukraine and the damage from the reaction by the US, the EU, and other jurisdictions in terms of sanctions. So which one is most damaging? In a way, if the sanctions participate in a punishment of Russia that makes it less likely that this kind of invasion happens in the future, I would argue, perhaps provocatively, that this is stabilizing for the world, but also for the global financial system. In other words, I will very much echo what Sylvia just said, which is, in this kind of situation, in wartime, it's very difficult to isolate one action from the rest. Everything happens at the same time.
Everything is endogenous, to use
exactly,
word that economists love.
Yeah, let's put a bit of jargon into this. So I think the everything comes from the Russian invasion, which frankly I didn't see coming. I thought until the last moment that the Russian regime would not be that reckless. And that's highly destabilizing. Whether the sanctions are add to that destabilization or are, in the big scheme of things, stabilizing because they re-establish better incentives, I think time will tell.
If I can add just one very quick thing on this before we move on to the banks. One thing that I think it's important to understand is that even the SWIFT sanction is a sanction on, so to speak, the mean you use to perform transaction. It's not a sanction preventing or prohibiting certain transactions. In particular, a lot of discussion is concerned energy transactions, so payment for energy transactions. Even in the US, when a similar measure was taken before the SWIFT sanction was introduced, energy payments were exempted. So there's another side to the story, which is whether Europe and allies will ever get to the point of actually enforcing also prohibition of transaction, for example, on energy, on oil and gas. So all these things are currently allowed. We know that this is a lifeline of the Russian economy. So of course that option remains open. The fact that it remains open is presumably supposed to work as a incentive to correct behavior, to quote what Nicola was saying, but it's a part of the story that needs to be taken into account as well.
Great. Maybe we can go back now to the ripple down effect on the banks and the spare bank, letting our listeners understand a little bit better this specific episode within this broader frame.
I mean, I think Sylvia already said it. Sberbank AG is a bank in Austria, which was, I think, fully owned by Sberbank in Russia, which is the largest Russian bank. And it itself, it had subsidiaries in Croatia, in Slovenia. And I think in Hungary, Sylvia, you may know better than me, but I think the Hungarian operation was a subsidiary of Sberbank AG, not of Sberbank Russia directly, right?
Yeah, I think so. To be honest, I'm not 100% sure on this, but I think so.
Anyway, what happened is that the ECB said, or the Single Resolution Board in Brussels, I don't remember the exact communication, that Sberbank AG in Austria was becoming illiquid. There were a number of its creditors or depositors that wanted to be repaid, and that was becoming disorderly. That's basically what they say. And so they say we had to take action. This bank was becoming likely to fail. So we declared it failing or likely to fail, which I understand was in this case a joint decision of the European Central Bank and of the Single Resolution Board, which are the authorities in charge of that in the Eurozone under the so-called banking union. And therefore they took actions with the tools they have. Initially, they imposed a moratorium on all the liabilities of Sberbank AG, which means everything was frozen for 2 days. Late yesterday, they announced the end of the moratorium, the fact that Sberbank AG itself in Austria was put into liquidation. I think that's being managed by a court. And the subsidiaries in Croatia and Slovenia are being purchased by local banks. So that's very orderly. They're out of the game now. They're in other hands. And the one in Hungary is also being liquidated by the Hungarian authorities. Of course, that's outside of the Eurozone. In an orderly way. So, problem solved. The big question is So first, will depositors lose money? Apparently not. If I get the communication right from what I've read this morning, some creditors may lose money on Sberbank AG, but also depositors, including uninsured German depositors, which had piled up into that bank for whatever reason, yield chasing, are going to get their money back, apparently. So basically, the authorities took action early enough that there was enough left in the bank to reimburse all the depositors, if not all creditors. The second question is there contagion from there to other banks? And I think the short answer is no. There's a separate question, which is the big Eurozone banks which have big operations in Russia or exposures in Russia. So that's Société Générale, Raiffeisen, UniCredit, Intesa San Paolo, ING in particular, but not only those. So how will that play out? But that's a different question, because that's about their Russian operations, not what's happening in the Eurozone. In the Eurozone, there are one or two other significant Russian or Russian-owned banks like VTB in Germany, RCB in Cyprus. None of this is very big. And basically, I don't expect this to create massive contagion. So I think I'm not worried about the systemic stability in the Eurozone or for that matter, elsewhere in the world in large financial jurisdictions at this point.
So if I may be a little bit not provocative, but kind of echoing several questions that are now floating the Slido page, are you trying to argue that there are no systemic consequences of these sanctions on the banking system, in at least at the European level? Or shall we say a little bit more about this broader picture kind of level? Like, this maybe applies for the specific case of the banks we just mentioned, but there is an actual consequence that we need to be aware of and start to discuss, because this is in several sources, there are several questions from the listeners about that, what actually is going to happen. I don't know if Sylvia or
Sylvia, do you want to have a go at this, or should I?
No, you start. I can.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I haven't seen the questions on Slido, so I don't know exactly how they're formulated. I think, you know, as usual, there is a lot of disinformation going on, some originating from Russia. And I think one of the messages from Russia is, we're strong, you're weak. So the current situation financially is the EU is strong and Russia is weak, and that's probably, you know, difficult to reconcile. So I wouldn't be surprised if there is a lot of disinformation coming from Russia going on, you know, propagating false rumors that there is instability in the European financial system that actually doesn't exist. Now, having said that, you know, this is a big shock. The shock of the invasion, not the shock of whatever actions the European Union is taking, but just the shock of the invasion. This was not anticipated by the markets, by and large. It's a massive change in the, you know, in our world. And things are developing on the ground, of course, resistance by Ukrainians, difficulties by the Russian military, but the Russian military is also very big and has a lot of firepower, and it's willing to use it, including against civilians. So this is happening. It's the background of everything we're talking about. And this is destabilizing. It's destabilizing for the world. It's destabilizing for the world financial system and for the European financial system. So that's this big shock. Do the sanctions add to the destabilization? It's not obvious to me. I wouldn't necessarily say so. I think it's a proportionate response. Actually, in the case of the EU sanctions on Russian banks, I think it's not even proportionate. It's too weak. But it can be fixed in the next few days. We'll see what happens. So I don't think there is destabilization coming specifically from there. There are pockets of vulnerability, as I mentioned, Eurozone banks' exposures to Russia, this issue of the Russian banks in the Eurozone. I think the Russian banks in the Eurozone is already solved as we speak, and that has been done in an orderly way. The exposures of European banks in Russia is still a bit of a question mark. I expect it to be much clearer in the next few weeks, if not days. I don't think, because that has been to a certain extent anticipated and stress tested by the relevant authorities, so I don't expect massive instability to come from there. Now, there can be other risks. For example, the likelihood of cyber attacks by Russia on the European financial system has increased dramatically with the invasion. And that's a risk. It may be destabilizing in the near term. Who knows?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the particularly when it comes to the question of the banks we were mentioning earlier, this is a very, very idiosyncratic case. And I don't think it will spill over or replicate in any way across the Eurozone. Regarding exposures of banks, Eurozone banks with activities in Russia, even there, I think there are distinctions. So there are outliers, Raiffeisen, obviously the obvious one. For the other banks we're talking about, I mean, exposures are significant, but still in proportion to the overall activities of the bank is not so relevant. So there's an obvious case where there is quite evident weakness. In the other cases, I think it's less clear cut in terms of the impact it will have. As Nicola was saying, this has been already looked through in a way because the ECB had asked, I think it was a month ago or even a couple of months ago, to the banks to be transparent about their exposures to Russia. In a way, this was already known. And so it doesn't come as a big surprise, a big shock. The question, I think, will be also for those banks operating there, banks who have obviously made investment in terms of expanding their network over the past years, what do they do with it? So even aside from the obvious outlier case of Raiffeisen, I think the question is, do you just walk away from it? So you just shell the problem in a way. You obviously take the equity loss, but at the same time, you sort of remove potential problems down the line, or you just try and wait it out and see, you know, like where this goes, where the geopolitical, the military situation goes, whether there's any resolution or not. And I think that's probably the most interesting question to ask and the most difficult decisions that management will have to take or authorities will have to force in a way. We'll have to see what happens there. And it's tied to how the military situation will evolve necessarily.
There are some other questions from the audience, and I would like to give as much space as possible to them, because that is also one of the reasons why we wanted to have this as a live session rather than a normal recorded podcast. For example, we have an anonymous who is asking, speaking about the effects, is asking what will be the effect of all these sanctions on the market of sustainable finance, if there is any.
Good one. I think that question has a lot of angles. There is obviously the sovereign angle to this. I think it was quite interesting to see ESG rating agencies rushing to downgrade Russian sovereign debt a couple of days ago when this happened. So I would say clearly being behind in terms of their assessment of the sustainability risk of that particular sovereign debt. So that's one angle. The other angle is obviously, I think, energy. And this is something that ties to the discussion we had before. So far, we still enjoy flows and promises of flows of Russian gas from Russia. For Europe, this is a very sizable issue in terms of the amount of energy consumptions that we cover through imports of Russian gas. So if that were not to be the case, we would have to resort to alternatives. Some of those alternatives are very polluting. I mean, it's been mentioned the possibility to ramp up coal-powered energy and electricity generation. So that would obviously be something that goes completely against what has been the path followed in Europe over the past few years. It also goes against the whole narrative and the whole direction sustainable finance has been going over the past years. And so it will trigger questions as to whether national security considerations, Trump considerations that had been becoming prominent, ever more prominent over the past few years in terms of, directing flows of capitals across different activities in the real economy. It's an open question, I think.
I would say, just on that, not disagreeing with Sylvia, but then there could be also a positive effect, which is reducing Europe's reliance on gas over the medium term, because gas is a less polluting energy than coal or oil, but it's still a greenhouse emission energy. So one possible effect of that is that the EU will get its act together in a way it wasn't able to in the last decade, will really work over the next, say, 5 years on a kind of post-Gazprom transition, if I can put it that way, cutting its reliance on Russian gas and adopting an accelerated investment into sustainable energy production to achieve that objective. So ironically, I agree with Sylvia. In the short term, that means more pollution because we have to, you know, get energy where it is, and some of it will be more polluting than what we may be losing from Russia. But in the medium term, it's not clear that the balance is so negative.
No, I agree. I mean, there's obviously a timing issue there. So short term, there are some difficult choices to make. I think medium term, the question is what kind of medium we're talking about, in the sense that even if you assume doubling production of energy from renewable resources every year, that it takes still quite some time to fill up the deficit that in energy that you would have if you were to ditch Russian gas completely. Even assuming that it can be compensated partly with LNG imports and all the other options that are out there. So it still takes quite some time to get there. So it will obviously be a sustainable finance investment opportunity for that period of time. But meanwhile, you have to balance this other kind of considerations in the short run.
Before we move on to another topic, I want to mention the extraordinary work done by our colleagues at Bruegel, Georg Sachmann, Simone Tagliapetta, and others, who have been documenting precisely this question of the post-Gazprom transition and how Europe can cope if, for whatever reasons, the current deliveries of Russian gas are terminated. And I think this has been a major contribution to the collective understanding of those issues in Europe in the last few days and recent past.
Absolutely, Nicolai, and we are going to link up because we had an episode of The Sound of Economics earlier this week on Monday on this issue together with Simone and Guntram Wolf. We are going to link it up to in the show notes as well as the backgrounders that you just mentioned. Moving to another topic, because we are really trying to understand the impact on the financial markets over there. The other big thing that seemed not to be too impactful, but today there were quite a lot of news on it, was on the market of crypto. I mean, of course, crypto becomes very soon some sort of an asset that is being grasped at the moment because it's decentralized in the moment where there is the sanctions and all these issues we've been saying around the banks on one side and the reserves on the other side. What is your take on that? I mean, we've been seeing bitcoins going skyrocketing, and also on certain markets in Russia, even going topping up. You know, like I think it was at 45,000 in the global markets, and some Russian websites were reselling at 60,000 or something like this. What's your take on that? I mean, what does it tell us beside the story about the moment? You know, we've been seeing peaks of bitcoins all the time, but what does it tell us, you know, more on the systemic side about the use of crypto? I think our listeners might be very interested about that.
My view is very short on this. My view is the sooner central banks and authority cranks down on crypto, the better. I mean, I think it's an asset that we have seen being linked to dubious activities, money laundering, different kind of trades. I really do think this is not something that should be sustainable in the long term. So my view on this is very short, and I think I'm going to leave it at that.
So I will be a little bit more nuanced, but not much more nuanced. I mean, the reason I'm not much more nuanced is that, like Sylvia, I think a lot of the crypto activity has been massively beneficial to malign actors, especially organized crime, including but not exclusively, far from it, from Russia. And so I think the authorities have been a bit too tolerant of an instrument that was used for purposes that are detrimental to society. Now, not all the crypto activity is linked to money laundering and crime, but much of it is. And therefore, I'm supportive of the effort, which I think is a little bit belated, that is being undertaken right now, separately from the reaction to the Ukrainian invasion, in order to put a little bit more discipline into that space. Now, on the circumstances here, crypto is well suited to war situations and situations of state failure, because in situations of state failure, it can happen that the national currency is actually even less credible than a cryptocurrency. And I don't think that's the case either in Russia or Ukraine right now for different reasons. Russia, because it still has a little bit of that fortress effect, even so it has been, as Sylvia explained very well, undermined by the sanctions.
Nicola, sorry, we've seen this like in Venezuela.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in Venezuela, we have hyperinflation. In Afghanistan, we had complete state failure. In Zimbabwe, we had hyperinflation as well. So when you have that degree of basically, you know, complete disappearance of the credibility of the state and of the central banks, then crypto becomes a plausible alternative store of value and also means of exchange. I don't think we're there either in Russia or in Ukraine, frankly. Russia still has resources and is still able to export its gas and oil. Ukraine is being supported by its friends. There's a very interesting story unfolding, which is the financing of Ukraine, access to liquidity by its central bank, access to the bond market by its sovereign. But at this point, my working assumption is that as long as the Ukrainian government is still functional, and at this point it is under siege, literally, but it is functional, it will continue to have access to finance, and therefore Ukraine will not be a failed state, and the occupied regions of Ukraine will not be failing either, because it will be provided financing by Russia, as Crimea and the Donbas have been in the last 8 years. So basically, long story short, crypto is part of the landscape, because everything is part of a landscape in a war zone. But I don't think it's at this point supplanting the Ukrainian hryvnia or the Russian ruble yet.
I mean, just as a evidence of what Nicola was saying about still remaining credibility, particularly of the Ukrainian state, I mean, Ukraine went out and raised money for war, issuing war bonds in the middle of a war, when it would be legitimate for investors to question the ability of the government to repay those bonds that it's trying to sell to raise money for war. And nevertheless, they're doing it. So, I mean, I think that's strong evidence that still credibility remains there.
It's just a small, I don't know if it's small, but it's a follow-up question from one of our listeners about this crypto issue. And then we move on, because we are also going towards the end of the episode. The person asked, is an anonymous, it doesn't state his name, could crypto be still used by Russian oligarchs for weapon purchase? I mean, you were mentioning dubious activities and so on.
Unfortunately, Russian oligarchs and the Russian state have access to much stronger finance at this point than crypto. So, you know, maybe they will use crypto like they use other things, but it's not their only option.
So that answered the question from our listener. And I would like to have one more question from our listeners, and then I have a final question from my side. This is, again, back into the systemic discussion and the systemic reflection we were having before. Is this war potentially accelerating the decoupling of financial systems? The person specifically says, with potentially China, Russia becoming one bloc and the West becoming another.
start. If I can start, I think, yes. I mean, that's definitely a shock that goes in that direction. I mean, China and Russia have been getting closer ever since 2014 in economic terms and financial terms. I think this is just going to accelerate that dynamic. Now, the question, I think, also is from the perspective of China, what is the best course of action for them? And I think for the time being, what their public positioning at least seems to suggest is that China is, again, waiting this one out. It's sort of not taking, obviously, I don't think anybody expected that, a very strong position against what Russia is doing. It's not proving exceptionally supportive or, as some were fearing, profiting from this and trying to move their own acts of aggression on Taiwan or South China Sea either. So they're sort of like in there waiting. I think from the perspective of the Chinese, probably the best outcome they might get is a weakened Russia that becomes a lot more dependent on China for its economic survival. And at the same time, that gives China access to a reservoir of commodities for a much cheaper price than they would otherwise be paying for it. So I think from their perspective, that would be the biggest payoff from this situation. Whether that happens obviously depends on the development on the military front in Ukraine. But at the same time, I think if we take out the scenario of the Russian government just backtracking completely from what they have been doing so far, which I think is very unlikely at this point, I don't really see a scenario where sanctions are lifted in the foreseeable future. So in that respect, I think we're really moving towards that scenario of China and Russia becoming more and more closely entangled together.
I take a different take on this. I disagree. Finally, we have a little bit of disagreement.
Yeah. Okay.
What we're seeing is decoupling of Russia.
In the last 3 minutes of the podcast.
This is happening. For China, they have to make a choice because probably they cannot stay coupled with Russia in a big way and at the same time coupled with the rest of the world as they currently are. So I think it's a very difficult situation for the Chinese leadership to be in, especially because they had this big show of unity with Putin on February 4, and there is every indication that Putin misled Xi Jinping, actually, at that point. He was played. So the Chinese will never admit that. But there are credible indications that he didn't tell Xi Jinping that he would invade Ukraine. And so the Chinese leadership apparently felt, like many other analysts, that he wouldn't do something so reckless. That matters. So basically what I'm saying is the connection with the rest of the world for China is immensely more valuable economically than any connection with Russia. Even if they buy Russia on the cheap, that doesn't match their connection with the rest of the world. So I don't think what we're seeing is decoupling of China from the rest of the world. We're seeing decoupling of Russia and China trying to have it both ways, but probably not forever.
Thank you. And I take the opportunity to make a little bit of an advertisement because we are going to keep this conversation about Russia and China tomorrow in another episode of our Sound of Economics Live together with Alicia Garcia Herrero and Elena Rybakova. And we are going to exactly discuss and spend a good 45 minutes on this topic because we cannot liquidate it in 3 seconds at the end of this episode. Now, I wanted to just have one sentence on this, but I know it's like a Pandora box. What more we have to expect? What else? What are the next step sanctions at the financial level that we might expect? We cannot close the episode without saying at least a word about that.
I think the only sanction we really have left that matters is really cutting off the Russian energy provision to ourselves. So in a way, accepting to hurt ourselves in the short run if we want to inflict a serious economic damage on the Russian economy.
And I agree on this one, but I think perhaps ahead of this one, there's just putting more Russian banks on the list of sanctions, because as I said, the list that was announced today only represents about a quarter of the Russian financial system. It could, and I believe should, go to 100% before we move on to something else.
And relatedly, the banks that are currently not on, like Gazprom Bank and Sberbank, exactly. are not on because they are vital for those energy transactions. So,
well, there's a question we didn't have time to discuss, but just to point, just to clarify, I think there are ways to engineer continuation of energy transactions, even if you put most of the Russian banking system on the sanctioned list and outside of SWIFT. So that's a technical question, but it's important in the circumstances, and I think clarifies the exchange we just had.
Great. And, well, it's not great, but thank you for this clarification, which is extremely important indeed. So thanks, and we really are going to close now this episode. I would like to say that part of the story we've been covering in this conversation with Silvia and Nicolas is connected to the broader macroeconomic implications of the war. And this conversation is not over, because now I will hand over for another live recording session just after this one, in which Guntram Wolf, the director of Bruegel, with Jean Pisani Ferri and Luis Garicano, will delve into this aspect as well. So stay tuned if you are connected right now, and you can keep going a little bit more deep into this issue with them. Stay tuned in general with The Sound of Economic, and check the previous episodes on our overall coverage of the economic consequences of the war as it unfolds on our website www.bruegel.org. Thanks a lot, Nicola and Silvia, for joining in. And thanks to all of you tuning in to listen to The Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.